The Bastards of Boston Baseball Podcast.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champion. Game over, series over, and the Red Sox are world champs again.
Yes, indeed. Here it comes. Another edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
The Boston Red Sox win a close one on the backs of an absolute pitching masterclass led by the one and only Brian Baio. They defeat the Yankees for the seventh time this year, this time by a score of 1-0, and raise the record on the season to 70 wins, 59 losses, once more vaulting themselves into the top wild card position. I'm Nick the Voice, joined by Terry Cushman Jr., and we are the Bastards of Boston. Want more? Go to bastardsofbostonbaseball.com for great written articles. Now, Terry, this was a masterclass. A lot of frustration on one side of the ball, of course, the bats having a lot of opportunities to score, not being able to once again. Max Fried pitching relatively well, but also shaky at times. A lot of traffic at certain moments that he didn't get punished for. But let's start this with the one and only, like I said, Brian Baio. I mean, this dude absolutely dealt. Seven innings pitched, only four base runners allowed, five strikeouts, and most importantly, zero earned runs, and all under 100 pitches.
Well, we're going to get into some pretty impressive stats here in a minute, but it's been a wonky season, and you know, we hadn't been scoring runs and we've been losing games because of it, and we haven't been scoring runs and now we're winning games. And you know, last night was a razor thin game until that Roman Anthony home run. And you know, so to come away with, you know, a one run win tonight, I mean, it's not exactly what you want to see, but you need to stack up the wins, especially having lost three in a row coming into the series. So was a big game. And getting to Brian Baio, I mean, it was kind of written on the wall, I think, after July 1st. I mean, he's always been a great second half pitcher, and this is the best first half he's had in his career. And you know, he's had trouble with injuries, not nothing major, but you know, he's had some slow starts because of it, missed some early games. And, but man, he got firing on all cylinders, and you know, he's lived and died on weak contact for a lot of the season, but you're starting to see more punch outs, which you should for a guy who throws 98 and Yankee Stadium against the Yankees in a series that feels like a playoff series. He got it done, and he wasn't rattled, and he outdueled Max Fried.
He really did.
The prize of last winter's free agency. You know, the Yankees ended up signing him, but we got Brian Baio.
Yeah, and I mean, is now a good time to point out that Brian Baio's ERA on the season is lower than Max Fried. Fried, by no means a bad pitcher, quite the opposite. He's had a few shaky games lately, but everyone's allowed a few of those. 3.14 ERA on the season. Brian Baio, a 3.07. And I know ERA isn't the whole picture. You look at FIP metrics, you know, I'm a big nerd like that. But when it comes to getting things done, Baio has been unbelievably effective. The only few times that he looked shaky tonight, he was immediately bailed out by good defense behind him. And that's one of the pros of a weak contact type of pitcher, right? Is that when you put a good infield behind him, they are going to make some magic happen. Story with a beautiful double play tonight. that was just a massive, massive, just unbelievable. And I really did think for a little bit there, do we bring Bayo out in the eighth? I mean, only 92 pitches. You can say 61 strikes on 92 pitches. That's so-so. It's not crazy. But I understand the logic of going to Whitlock, but part of me was like, oh, man, just give him another. Give him Jason Dominguez at least.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't at this point hesitate to throw him out there for an eighth inning if the pitch count justifies it. And earlier in the year, I mean, he threw around what 110, 112. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's not what you want to see, a guy who's not particularly healthy early on. And, you know, so, I mean, you're automatically getting six or seven innings out of him now. And efficiency was never a thing for him. Like, you know, 80, 85 pitches by the end of the fourth inning. And you're just praying that he gets you through that fifth inning. And a lot of times he didn't. And now, I mean, he saves your bullpen. And so I'm not going to nitpick on, you know, whether he should have stayed in a little bit longer or not. I mean, and is there a better 1-2 punch in baseball in the eighth and ninth than Whitlock and Chapman?
Whitlock is looking like himself. He is looking like peak Warlock era, which is so, so important. And the idea of adding guys to this bullpen, we're talking about Walker Buehler, and maybe we can speculate a little bit on that later on. Walker Buehler moving out of the rotation to the bullpen, Slayton potentially returning sooner rather than later. But Whitlock, just unbelievable tonight. And Chapman, absolutely automatic, aided only on his one ground out. David Hamilton made a really, really good play. So props to him, you know, credit where credit is due. Really, really just good. I mean, seven innings from your starter, and then you go right to your setup man and closer. You can't script it any better than that, especially with two Ks apiece in the eighth and ninth.
Yeah, I said last night with Jason and Doug, you know, it was a one-run game until the ninth, and I had already said in the war room going into the eighth, I'm like, I think it's over. You know, you got Whitlock, you got Chapman. And then Anthony hits the I think it was a two-run shot, and I was like, geez, well, I hope Cora doesn't overthink it and not bring in Chapman, because, you know, I would trust a one-run lead with Chapman than a three-run lead with anyone else. Now that, especially with Whitlock already having come out of the game. So, yeah, it's just, it's really, I mean, like you said, you couldn't have scripted it any better. And it's nice to have Bayo under control for a while. I think you have him for, what, at least three more years after this. We can check on that in a second. But I just hope this is who he is, you know. Looking at the American League right now, he's eighth in earned run average at 307. Not surprisingly, I mean, Tarek Skubal, Garrett Crochet are ahead of him. Jake DeGrom is pitching very well into his late 30s. He's got a 2.76 ERA. How are his strikeouts? A little over one per inning. And Bayo, not quite well under one per inning. So hopefully, I mean, he is trending upwards as far as strikeouts go. So I'm just kind of looking to see if he'll get some Cy Young votes. And he might, but, you know, a strong finish would certainly get him possibly closer to the top five. I don't know if that's realistic because, again, you know, the three pitchers I named there, plus you still have Hunter Brown in there. Nathan Eovaldi, surprisingly, has the lowest ERA in the American League at 1.73, but only 130 innings pitched. So he's been injured a little bit. But man, I remember early in the season, Bayo scuffled a little, and I'm like, is this guy just ever going to find it? Like, you know, you sign him to an extension, and it's not like it was the worst thing ever. You know, it was basically the same deal that Christian Campbell signed and Rafaela, you know, somewhere in the 60 million range. So that's typically not going to be hugely consequential, but I just, he's your number two starter now at this point, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's so easy to forget that this guy is only 26 years old because he's been in the league for a while. He came up very young, and he is just steadily improving his game. And this year, without question, is his best year out of the previous four, or out of the previous three, I should say. And earlier in the season, there was some debate all over Red Sox Twitter, all over Red Sox really fandom, which was, who is our number two? Is it Giolito or is it Bayo? And at this point, I think Bayo is the clear favorite for that position.
Yeah, I guess the question is, you know, should he be? You know, the Red Sox could probably do a little bit better with their rotation building, and Giolito continues to not be terrible, but, you know, wasn't super solid there. And I think, you know, the big problem with Giolito at his worst was the balls were leaving the yard. One of those years, it might have been 2023, he led Major League Baseball among qualified starters in most home runs given up. And he did give up a home run shot to Ben Rice, but the ball, for the most part, is staying in the park. You know, the walks have ticked up with Giolito, but if you can get him back, I mean, there's your 1-2-3 again. But I think I'm at the point where I think Bayo's ceiling is probably higher than Giolito's at this point. So that would essentially keep him as your number two regardless.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the thing with Bayo is, when you take a pitcher that ultimately doesn't walk guys, which he's been getting better about, he's really getting his control under control. And a guy who induces weak contact, the strikeouts aren't as important, but even those, like you said, are seeming to trend upwards a little bit. He's been phenomenal in a lot of ways. And I saw a comment I wanted to point out. Brian Simmons said he finally has his emotions under control and his changeup is back. And both of those things are true, but especially the emotional part. The guy just, he was always his own worst enemy on the mound, as a lot of pitchers are. But this year, you know, we heard about his family coming over. They were back, you know, in another country for a while. And having his kids there, having his wife there, and just getting a little older, you know, there's a big difference between 22, 23, and 26, you know, just mentally. And he has matured so quickly and really has a lot more confidence in himself. He'll get into a jam and you can just sort of see the difference, where he shakes it off and says, you know what, I'm going to find a way out of this. And so far this year, he has more than he hasn't.
That's an excellent point, because, yeah, he was emotional. And you could see him at times, you know, in previous seasons, just completely lose his composure, you know, just kind of putting his glove up to his face and just like swearing into it, saying God knows what. And, yeah, I mean, he's quietly a guy that's locked in. And, you know, I was frustrated, you know, to start the season. I'm like, every winter he hangs out with Pedro and Pedro breaks him and we don't see him until about May because of that. And, you know, maybe the one thing, you know, that he has picked up from Pedro is the relentless, you know, determination, and maybe Pedro's kind of helped him stay composed, because Pedro was a Yankees killer for a while. And I think he scuffled a little bit, you know, in 03, 04, he had the famous, the Yankees are my daddy's comment, and, you know, which gave the Yankees that chant for a while. But yeah, I mean, give me the guy that can go into Yankee Stadium, the most hostile possible environment you could possibly pitch, probably one of the least friendly pitcher ballparks that you could possibly pitch in as well, and own them. Give me that guy. I don't care if he's a number two all year long. That guy is going to put you on his back into the postseason. John Lackey did that. He was a great postseason pitcher. And, you know, maybe that's who Bayo is going to be with that Pedro-esque, you know, determination to get the job done.
Yeah. You know, I think you see that a lot when it comes to pitchers sometimes. Mindset is a big part of the game. You know, Jules, great comment about Kane O'Neill and Coney were very impressed with Bayo. I was listening to the WEEI broadcast. It was the same exact thing. I mean, you can see and hear, obviously, but you can just see this quality about him this year. His arsenal is good. And it's always been one of those things where you would imagine he would be a bigger strikeout pitcher than he is. If he can add that element to his game going forward and even become, what is it right now per nine strikeouts for him? Because if he could get that up to like 8 per 9, even, that would be beautiful.
That won't happen this year.
Not this year.
He's 30 strikeouts under the 1 per inning rate. So he had a 6.8 strikeout per nine, which is below league average. That's why I said, you know, he's really living on ground balls and soft contact. Coming into today, he's got it's still 6.8 strikeout per nine. So, I mean, he could get it above 7, and I think league average is somewhere between 7 and 7.5. But, but you know, maybe this is a building block season. Maybe the strikeouts are going to come, you know, in the upcoming seasons, but he figures it out, and that's kind of what veteran pitchers do. One of the big things today, Walker Buehler will come out of the rotation, but I'll give Buehler props on one thing. You know, being the veteran that he is kind of kept him in those games recently that weren't pretty, but he kept us in them, and we did put up some W's. One was against the Padres. I can't remember if we won or not, and I don't think we won in his last start. I'm not positive though. But yeah, so you know, as these guys go into their careers, they evolve, they adapt, and they find ways to help their team win. So Bayo, like you said, only 26 years old. Randy Clemens kind of did the research for us. He's basically under team control through 2029. So that's 4 more years beyond this. And then there's a $21 million option for a 5th year, which is a no-brainer if he's healthy. So
yeah, and you mentioned the infamous Yankees are my daddy comment that Pedro made. I'd like to go back to a comment earlier in the stream that Brad Sandler left. Bayo is the only Sox pitcher in history to pitch back-to-back 7 innings, 0 runs, 3 hits versus the New York Yankees, which is unbelievable. And just before the show, I actually saw a tweet, and I ended up retweeting it, which is from @SoxNotes on Twitter. And according to him, lowest ERA against the Yankees this century with a minimum of 50 innings pitched belongs to Brian Bayo at 1.95 career against the Yankees. What the heck? That is unbelievable.
You know, and then before the game, we were chatting about that. And I'm like, I thought that this could be a Yankees win tonight. And had I known that last night, I mean, it would have been pretty obvious by the 3rd or 4th inning how the game was going to go. And that's how it went.
Yeah, 100%. You know, we can shift to talking about the offense in a little bit here, but just one last thing I would like to point out about Whitlock and Chapman in particular is I was looking at the monthly breakdowns, and Whitlock is on an absolute tear that I didn't even realize how good he's been. I know he's been good all season, but particularly in the past 2 months. In July, Whitlock had 10 appearances with a 0.96 ERA. So far in August, he has had 11 appearances with a 0.96 ERA, funnily enough. J- just absolutely dominant in that time span. Meanwhile, you look at Chapman, who pitched 12 appearances in June, zero ERA. And then he's doing it again so far in August in his 9 appearances without surrendering a run or even surrendering a hit. So far in August, he has pitched 8 innings and only given up 1 walk. Absolute dominance. It's ridiculous. We mentioned earlier in the season, and a lot of people have been comparing him to guys like Papelbon, guys like 2013 Koji or Pete Kimbrell. I think that every day that passes, he somehow finds a way to impress me more just by keeping that pace up.
You got a glimpse of it in 2021, and then they broke him, a couple of times. One of them resulted in another Tommy John, and I mean, we haven't had an eighth inning guy like this since probably 2008 to 2010 with Daniel Bard. I mean, we've had some closers, Kimbrell for a while, and and Chapman recently, and I hope we keep Chapman because I want to keep this intact, and I'll give him that 2-year deal to keep Whitlock in the eighth, Chapman in the ninth. That, I mean, just think of all the games you're going to win with that type of lockdown stuff. And if we don't keep him, we know where Whitlock's going to be pitching, going forward. It'll probably be the ninth. But man, it's just been fun to watch him do it. And he's a guy like Bayo that I've pointed out time and time again. Composure was an issue for Whitlock. And, the game would kind of speed up on him. And I remember Xander Bogaerts just walking to the mound from shortstop being the guy that's going to calm him down. And, and I'm not even going to say Whitlock's quietly put this together. I mean, he has just been utterly dominant in that inning. And I keep saying they're probably the best 1-2 punch. He has to be the best eighth inning guy, like undisputed in Major League Baseball this year.
If not, he's up there. I mean, this is a guy who in the past has been a closer potential guy for us. I imagine on many teams in the league, he would be the closer. And fortunately, I saw Brad Sandler say, if only Hicks was half as good as Whitlock, which is very true. I mean, that would be very nice. Wilson's been struggling a little bit very recently, but Weissert's been good. Bernardino's been good. Mats has been pretty decent. We'll see what Buehler has for us in the pen, if he's a different animal. But with Slayton's return, of course, if this pen stays healthy, it's a Super Bowl pen. It really is. And we didn't need to go and make a bunch of trades at the deadline for it. We built this, some homegrown guys. Funnily enough, three of them being ex-Yankees, right? In terms of Weissert. Yeah, Weissert, Whitlock, and Chapman, and actually Fitz is an ex-Yankee too, or at least from the system. So it's really funny to sort of take their scraps and shove it down their throat tonight and say, oh yeah, Whitlock and Chapman, you guys could have had that. That's some salt in the wound.
Yeah. And it's just so crazy how things pan out, because the Yankees gave up on Whitlock because he couldn't stay healthy. And they utilized him as a starter, throughout the minors. That's what they were trying to do with Whitlock. And then he kept getting hurt, so they put him in the Rule 5. And I guess there were reports that the Yankees didn't expect him to actually get picked, but he did. And when you're a Rule 5 pick, you go to your new team, you have to stay on the big league club for that full year. And if the new club decides not to keep him on the major league roster, that player has to be returned to the other team. So that's how Whitlock ended up in the pen. And that's how the revelation began. I mean, he was our closer that year. He had a 1.96 ERA. And, you know, and then we tried as best as we could to screw it up. As brilliant of a move as it was for Heim to get him, Heim almost really blew it for him. But yeah, now he's back to the pen, and he's one of the most dominant, you know, is the most dominant eighth inning guy in Major League Baseball. And since we're talking contracts, we've got him guaranteed through next year. And then there's a couple of options, which team options, by the way, $8.25 million for 2027, and then a $10.5 million option for 2028, which, by the way, will be his age 32 season. So it's not like he'll be a spring chicken going into free agency, but you have him, if you want him, under control for three more years. And, you know, with him being relatively older, hitting the market, I think that gives the Red Sox a lot of leverage in terms of maybe extending him a year or two early. So I hope that happens. And just to put this eighth and ninth inning into perspective, most of us were pretty happy with Chris Martin and Kenley Jansen. Like, that was a very serviceable eighth and ninth inning. And we know Kenley was prone to a blown save here or there, but for the most part, you know, he was reliable. He lived up to the contract, and we weren't missing the postseason because of the eighth and ninth innings. Now we have Whitlock and Chapman, and just look at how much more amazing that is.
Yeah, it's a huge step up. You know, we've talked about the good, and now we can maybe get into the bad and the ugly part, where, of course, the pitching was amazing. The Yankees were 0-for-0 with runners in scoring position. I mean, that speaks for itself. The Red Sox were a familiar 1-for-11, which, again, I mean, yesterday we could have won that game, you figure, 10-3. Tonight, this very well could have been, well, a 3-0 win for sure. Bregman, of course, hit that close ball. And I'm actually just on Baseball Savant right now, just on the game page, sorting by hit distance. And there were a few ones tonight that I think all of us, as soon as it left the bat, we were like, oh, is it going to make it? Is it going to fall? Nate Eaton with a fly out in the fifth. Absolutely smoked the ball 391 feet to center, had an expected batting average of .910. So poor Eaton had a terrible game between that and then the terrible, terrible caught stealing after working a walk or being gifted a walk, depending on the ump. I forget if that was one of the bad at bats. I know the ump was definitely, someone else said it in chat, a pitcher's ump tonight, without question. At one point, Rafaela had a called strike so low to the ground, it was ridiculous. But Alex Bregman had a ball hit. It would have been gone in five parks, which I know that means there's 25 that it wouldn't have been. But I mean, he just was so close to making this a 3-0 ball game right there. Trevor Story had a good hit. Nate Lowe had a good hit. Nearly scored himself another double, I would say. And speaking of Lowe, the pinch hit that Cora made in the seventh. You know, Rafaela flies out, and with Nate Eaton up, this is where it's nice to have guys who play different positions. Nate Eaton was out in center field. Romy was over at first. Sedan was playing second base. We bring in Nate Lowe to pinch hit for our center fielder in Eaton, move Romy over to second, and move Sedan out to center field. I mean, I love having that flexibility. I think that's exactly what the philosophy of the Red Sox, that's what they've been trying to go for with these sort of platoon players, these guys who can, or utility, I should say, who play all over the place. You sort of saw that trend as soon as like Kike Hernandez was signed, right? And tonight we got a very good example of what that flexibility can do. Nate Lowe comes out, a beautiful, beautiful double to right field. And then Connor Wong gets his second hit of the game, a beautiful double to left. Just unbelievable to see Wong finally have a good game. And it's funny because this is a guy who hasn't been blowing the doors off the place by any means. But in the last seven games, he's slashing .286, .318, .381. And with Narvaez slumping pretty badly the last 2 months, we need Connor Wong to step up and show us why he still is on this roster. Tonight, he did that.
Well, I mean, I've given Connor Wong a lot of grief and deservedly so, but I've also said I don't think he's this bad. I mean, he's been a pretty good hitter who's been a little bit prone to strikeouts in previous years, but you're starting to see it. And now I'm wondering who Carlos Narvaez really is. I mean, he's had 7 or 8 hot weeks and that's it. You know, because Kong got most of the at-bats in April till he got hurt. And then Narvaez really in May and June was awesome. And then from July forward, he's hitting, what, .125, something like that? It's pretty ugly. Yeah, so it's nice to see Wong kind of step it up. And as someone said, I wished I should have profiled it. And maybe I can find it in a second here. But Wong is essentially Bayo's personal catcher. You know, that happens. And we didn't really hear it this year, but you know, you always hear managers say there's going to be no personal catchers at all this year. And then by June, it's like, you know, everybody's got their catcher because, you know, winning is important. And so anyway, you know, you can expect that Wong's probably going to be catching Bayo for the rest of the year and potentially into October. And so we'll see how it plays out, but thank goodness we didn't put him in a trade. You know, he would have been the second or third piece in whatever trade that was, but sometimes you just get lucky and by letting it play out.
Most definitely. You know, in the top of the ninth, we had another pinch hit, which ultimately, in a roundabout way, did help us win the game in a funny way, just because Yoshida pinch hit for Romy, and then Hamilton came in to play second base, and he ended up making a really great play in the bottom of the ninth and potentially saved Chapman a hit. Obviously, not that a single is going to do all that much against Aroldis this year, but, you know, he'll just, oh, no, I'll strike out 3 guys instead of 2, maybe. But it's definitely something worthy of noting. But when it comes to Yoshida hitting, it's just the most predictable thing ever, and I hate it, because I like Masataka Yoshida. I want him to be good. He's a nice guy. He's fun to root for. I love his energy. But this contract, he does the same thing. I swear, it's like Groundhog Day, where we get, I think it's 2 men on, right, to start the ninth. Jaron Duran walks, steals, and then Anthony Volpe makes, it wasn't scored an error, but it should have been. I know it's technically not because it's just a fielder's choice that was botched, but it was the most boneheaded play where Rafaela hit it to Volpe and Volpe threw it to second base as if it was a force out. And obviously Jaron Duran started at second base. So he just gets back to the bag. Jazz looks confused. For a moment, you think, you know, you see like a thought bubble go over his head. He's like, wait, why do I have this? Oh, no, he throws it to first. He's too late. So we started with 2 guys on, and unfortunately, we just couldn't figure it out. You know, Lowe advanced both runners on a flyout. Connor Wong hit a fielder's choice. I saw some people say that Duran shouldn't have come home. I think it was a fine decision in that situation. Sedan moved from second to third anyway. I'm personally not too bothered about it. But then we have 2 men in scoring position because Connor Wong stole second. Definitely wheels for a catcher. You can say that. And Yoshida pinch hits for Romy Gonzalez. And what does he do? He grounds out lightly to the infield. And I can't stand it. What? Oh my goodness. It breaks my brain. It genuinely does.
Yeah. I mean, you could streamline this roster so much better if you could just get Yoshida off the team and be able to, you know, mix and match with your DH on various nights. And it makes the pathway for, you know, Yustinson Garcia to potentially stay up. And not that he had a great game. He drew a walk, struck out 3 times. He was facing Max Fried, who basically pitched a gem, but it just messes with the algorithm so bad by having Yoshida in there. And he's just a huge net negative. Now, next week against Baltimore, maybe he'll go off and then people will feel justified that he's on the team, but it's going to cycle back, and it's just more pain than pleasure with that guy.
Most definitely. I think we are at a point where, when it comes down to the creation of a postseason roster, Yoshida really has to have a hot end of this year to justify being on there. If we are healthy, if you have Ref Snyder, Abreu, you've got to have Anthony, Duran, preferably Rafaela out in center field if you can. Best way to do that is to give someone the DH, whether it's Duran and Ref Snyder, maybe, whether it's Anthony, whether it's anyone, you know. Yoshida doesn't look comfortable in the field. He never has. And it's just, he doesn't have the power I need from a DH. It's too consistent. And unfortunately, when you have a guy who hits ground balls that often, he's just a double play machine.
I can't really add anything other than that. You know, I just, it destroys my soul, you know, to see him in there. And I wonder if there's a mandate, you know, to where Breslow just isn't allowed to eat money. You know, maybe that came down from ownership. I mean, it felt like Trevor Story was on the verge of being DFA'd, but who really knows if he was at this point. And I think they're going to have to eat the Hicks contract, the remaining $25 million he has. I mean, he's got no options. So all you can do is phantom IL him, and maybe he'll work on stuff this winter, continue that through spring training, and maybe be serviceable next year. I think that's the best case with Hicks. But with Yoshida, if he's on this roster in 2027, that's the final year of his deal. Oh, man.
It's just tough. I mean, and exactly what we were talking about, you know, how I said that this roster has really been trying to gain flexibility. You get guys who can play around the diamond all over the place. And Yoshida is the antithesis of that. This is a guy who can't really play anywhere. He can DH, and he doesn't even do that all that well. So it's just tough. And that's a bit uncharitable, I guess you could say. He has been a pretty decent hitter, specifically versus righties, the past 2 years. But, I mean, this year he's just not getting it going, and we have better options. And next year we're going to have those same better options, if not even better options. Because, like you mentioned, the password, Yastenson Garcia, the three strikeouts tonight were an ugly look against good pitchers, granted, like you said. But one thing I've noticed about him is, coming up through the minors, his swing is very Manny-esque. And I don't say that lightly. You really look at it and you're like, oh, wow, that guy, like, that dude clearly watched Manny Ramirez growing up, you know what I mean? And even tonight, you know, on his strikeouts and whatnot, I was like pulling a muscle just watching him swing the bat. I mean, the guy is vicious up there, where if he makes contact, which, I mean, he's adjusted to every level. Who's to say the majors aren't next? If this dude makes contact, this could be a real level of power added to this lineup that it badly needs.
Yeah, I mean, you want to see him be disciplined in the batter's box. And I've complained that Abreu kind of feels like an all or nothing guy. He does draw walks, but and Garcia did draw a walk tonight, but we'll see. I mean, we're all calling for Peter Fatsy's head, and we got hot, and you know, maybe they can work that out. But if Abreu comes back, I think Garcia gets sent back down. And I think the fact that Abreu isn't already on the injured list, that tells me he's not really looking at a very severe injury. So We'll see. I mean, I've never seen a surplus of outfielders like we have now with the Red Sox.
Most definitely. And I'm not necessarily expecting Garcia to be a big contributor this year necessarily, or a postseason hero. But the guy is young. He's pretty good defensively from what I've seen. And I mean, ultimately he does have that power that if they can unlock it at the major league level, it's going to be dangerous. It's funny. Brad Sandler says he looks like Rafaela on roids. You're not wrong about that. Even in AAA, I mean, I pulled up his prospect savant page, and even down in AAA, I mean, this is a guy, he strikes out a lot. He chases a lot. He doesn't really walk all that much. He lives and dies on elite power. That does present an issue, obviously. Hopefully they'll be able to sort of elevate his game. But if they don't, I mean, you have a pretty good fourth outfielder, you'd say. And in addition to that, actually, I'm pretty sure he has very good splits as well, specifically versus lefties, meaning obviously Ref Snyder has been talking about retirement. If he does leave this year, Yastinson seems like the natural successor in that role.
Speaking of roles, I mean, hire Ref Snyder to be the hitting coach if need be. I mean, like I said, the future's bright. And according to Brad, my bad, Abreu is on the injured list. That was yesterday. I didn't see it. So second show in a row, I've kind of walked into something. I didn't realize Nathan Lau had an extra year left of arbitration. So that's interesting.
Didn't realize that either.
Yeah. Yeah. So that came out last night. I thought he was purely a rental at this point. But which makes it more curious, why did Washington not want him? I mean, if they, I don't know what their plans are for next year, but he looks like a guy you might want. And he's a lefty that can hit right lefties. So his splits are pretty even. But
yeah, you know, with him, I think it's maybe less of a situation of Washington not wanting Nathaniel Lowe and more of Nathaniel Lowe not wanting Washington. From what we heard, he was very unhappy over there.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, I mean, this is a guy, he spent his first 2 years with Tampa Bay. He was part of that 2020 Tampa Bay season. Then he went to Texas. He was there for 4 years. So he's been a part of two World Series teams, even if one was, you know, a World Series Mickey Mouse appearance, you know, you could say during the shortened year. But to go to Washington this year, some people could say maybe he's toxic. Maybe he is. I don't know. But he came to Boston and we were all joking, oh, dude, you don't know what you're walking into. If you think you're getting into a World Series team, be careful. Temper your expectations. And so far in his time here, Nathaniel Lowe has said, don't worry, I'm going to make you guys a World Series team. You know, he has sort of banished Toro down to the shadow realm. And now we have a first baseman that I feel way more confident in.
All the way around, I mean, offensively, defensively, I mean, you've seen him catch some relatively difficult pop-ups, you know, over by the tarp and the netting. And, you know, so that's pretty good. I keep calling him great value Schwarber. maybe he's going to be almost as good. I mean, he doesn't strike out as much as Schwarber does and draws a similar amount of walks. He's got a career on base of 347. So that's good. I mean, if you got a year of control, I don't see why they won't try to find a role for him. And that makes it even more difficult to keep Yoshida as well. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, you can tell he's liking it. You know, he's had two big hits so far. And another one tonight, actually. So
yeah, one off the bench too tonight now. So yeah, it's always nice to have a guy who's comfortable pinch hitting. You get some guys who aren't.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you look at first base and it's been a black hole. I mean, you had 3 months of Casas. You had Dahlbeck for a little while. You had the Moreland and Pierce platoon, and that was fine, I guess. And then before that you had Hanley. So it's like, it's been a long time since you've had like,
Mike Napoli type of figure, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Napoli was great. And I remember sitting through that winter hearing people say, you know, Napoli can't play first base. He's that's never going to work. And he was Scoops McGee over there and was fine, you know, and just, man, I mean, just embodied that whole Beard of Brothers team, you know, in 2013, and had the most epic post game, you know, after the World Series. He's got his shirt off, he's smoking, walking into random bars. But yeah, Lowe looks like he, you know, he's got that beer belly going on. So
he's great so far. I'm loving it. You know, it's just a different tool belt. You know, it really is. Like you said, a good on base, a good eye goes a long way, right? It helps prevent slumps. And that was one of the things that drove me crazy about Toro, is he was always chasing out of the zone and whatnot. And, you know, props to Toro for doing what he did back in May. He had a very nice little stint there. But, I mean, Lowe is the type of guy, you have to wonder, where would we be, right, this season if Lowe was in the system, if Lowe was our backup to Casas, if we were able to make a trade for a guy like this so early on like we wanted. We really stuck out a lot of games at first base, throwing out a guy and just sort of hoping for the best.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine how he would have fit in with Devers still here. And I mean, Romy, I don't know. It's hard to imagine that it would have panned out the way that it did. But I mean, we've kind of skated so far. I mean, you're what, 11 games above 500 now, I think. And you still got a shot at the division.
Yeah.
We are only scoring, you know, not many runs a night. So theoretically that's going to turn at some point and you'll put up more runs, but yeah, we've got him now though. And you know, we got Schwarber in 2021 and that gave you a lot of stability, and he wasn't really the beast in the postseason that, you know, we thought we'd have. I mean, it was mostly Kike, Verdugo, Vasquez, Bogarts were all having big moments, probably JD in there as well. Schwarber wasn't really big during that run through the ALCS there into game six, but yeah, we'll see. And I mean, I can't imagine he's not going to be an everyday guy to some degree. If he's not playing first, he'll, you know, potentially be DHing. And he's a 260 hitter basically against righties and lefties with a high on base, and he can mash. I mean, that was a piss missile the other night against Baltimore. We ended up blowing it later on, but he pumped some life into us for a few innings anyway.
Most definitely. At this point, I mean, I think that Lowe and Romy are probably your ideal first and second base starters. Romy's, you know, we'll see what he can do versus righties on an everyday level. And then you keep a guy like David Hamilton in your back pocket to be a defensive substitution. And from there, I mean, like you said, you just sort of hope that the offense is going to tick up. Bregman obviously had another very good night, and that was despite having a could-have-been home run or double turned into a flyout. You had a couple of well-struck balls. So you got to hope, you know, that Anthony, who had a bad night tonight, he'll get right back to it. Guy like Story, Jaron, so on and so forth. Let's take a look at probable matchups and see what the Sox are looking at for the other two games this series. So tomorrow we have a day game, a 1:05 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time start. That'll be Garrett Crochet versus Will Warren, which should be a very fun outing. Then on Sunday we have a game on ESPN starting at 7:10 p.m., and that will be Dustin May, primetime, versus Carlos Rodon. How are you feeling?
Theoretically, on paper, I feel pretty good. You know, this is a big game for Crochet. It's, I forget what he did previously against New York, but this is this is a moment where you want to see him thrive. A couple starts ago, was he tipping pitches? I'm not sure. It'll be interesting to see how the Yankees prepare for him and, you know, how he handles that lineup. But on paper, I got to go with Crochet. And I know he hasn't looked good the last couple times out. This is the biggest load he's ever had. So we're officially in uncharted waters with him as far as innings pitch. So we'll see, but I'll ride the momentum and I'll take the Red Sox. If we take the L, we're fine. We're 10 games above 500. And we all said coming into this, we're happy with a split. And that's the worst case at this point anyway.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like you said, worst case scenario, it's kind of status quo and a pretty good status quo at that. I mean, the Yankees being the get right series after a crushing loss to Baltimore is a very funny concept. Being 7-1 against the Yankees on the season, even if we lose the next two games, going to 7-3. Garrett Crochet, to answer your question, he pitched twice against the Yankees this year back in June. That was when he faced them back to back. That first game was a bit of a blow up, 5 runs on 6 hits in 6 innings. Then 6 nights later, he absolutely dealt, and that's where he pitched the 8.1 innings pitched, and then I believe gave up that solo shot in the 9th and got pulled. So,
So
ultimately, you know, this will be his first time seeing them and their first time seeing him in a little while. I got to feel good about Crochet. I mean, Will Warren is no slouch. Carlos Rodon deserves a lot of respect, too. I'm feeling good. If we are able to split these next two games, go 1-1, then that means that we have ultimately gained ground on the New York Yankees, hopped them yet again in the standings, and hopefully this time we can keep it that way. So I'll say I'm feeling good. I'll say we win tomorrow, and then on the primetime game, maybe Dustin May can surprise us. I'm going to say that Rodon probably has a good game, and the Yankees win it ultimately. But I'm thinking we split these next two to ultimately take the series 3-1.
I'm with you. I'm not going to say it's an automatic L on Sunday, but that does not look good. And we've hit pretty well against Rodon, but it just seems like the lefty magic isn't quite what it was. And I guess that'll be my iPad take for the night.
Well, especially with Ref on the IL, you know, you have half of your duo, right? The lefty assassins.
He had kind of cooled off anyway since late June, but I don't know. I mean, you had Fried tonight, and he's a lefty who hadn't even been pitching well and seemed to we didn't figure it out. Let's put it that way. So we'll see, but I don't like Dustin May in that environment. And I don't know. He could be a little bit wild, but we'll see.
Most definitely. With that, any closing thoughts?
I think we got it. I think we're 3 in a row tomorrow.
Yeah, hopefully. And we'll see what happens with Bueller's spot in the rotation too. I see a little speculation down in the comments, actually. Brad Sandler saying, I wouldn't be surprised if the Sox moved Crochet's start to Sunday and maybe started Fitz tomorrow. I could definitely see something like that happening just to give Crochet a rest day. But ultimately, I really like the Crochet-Warren matchup. You know, you try to win the series. Obviously, you'd love a sweep, but ultimately, we'll see. I mean, the Sox have a chance to really do something excellent here and potentially lock themselves up into a great wild card position where we were speculating after those 3 bad losses that, ooh, you know, this race is getting a lot tighter than we would like it to be. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I've been Nick, joined by Terry. We have been the Bastards of Boston. We appreciate you sticking with us, and let's hope the Sox can pull it out tomorrow. Let's go, Boston.